This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of June 10th, 2024. After a sweeping 34-month investigation, the U.S. Justice Department says it has found severe violations of federal law and the Constitution committed by the Phoenix Police Department. The feds say outside reform is needed in each area reviewed by civil rights attorneys. Matthew Casey reports.
The feds say Phoenix police use excessive force, retaliate against protesters, discriminate against minorities and people with mental health problems. The feds also say over-policing of homeless people is a central pillar of Phoenix's enforcement strategy. Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark.
Ultimately, our findings reveal evidence showing long-standing dysfunction at the Phoenix Police Department. The problems at their core reflect a lack of effective supervision, training, and accountability.
Phoenix police unions are reacting to the announcement with words like disappointing, frustrating, and appalling. Mayor Kate Gallego says the city council will meet in secret later this month to discuss the findings. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Now from Untold, Arizona. A neighborhood that spans eight city blocks near the intersection of North Stone Avenue and West Speedway Boulevard in Tucson was once the final resting place for thousands of residents. And as Bridget Dowd reports, many of them are still there more than a century later.
Almost like the famous scene from the 1982 film Poltergeist.
You left the bodies and you only moved the headstones! You only moved the headstones!
Some homeowners in the Dunbar Spring neighborhood of Tucson had no idea their homes were built on top of a cemetery when they purchased their properties. One of those is Moses Thompson, who bought his home in 2006.
We had only been in the house maybe a month, and a sinkhole opened up in front of the house.
Thompson thought he had a sewer line break, but he started digging and found that the soil was dry.
And then I found some brass, like decorations, like some diamond pattern, like brass pieces, and then I found a cross. And then I hit some boards.
He reached in and pulled out a handful of bones. He sent a photo of them to his wife, who's a pediatrician.
She's like, they could be human bones, but they're just really small.
So Thompson contacted a local archaeologist and described everything he found.
He was like, you 100% hit a human grave. Your house was built over the Court Street Cemetery.
That archaeologist, Homer Teal, excavated the grave and found it was a small child.
I scraped my trowel and discovered that there was another person underneath, and that was an adult male. He had identical coffin hardware, which indicates the two people were buried at the same time.
Teal has actually supervised the excavation of about 25 graves in the area since 2005, but that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Based on the number of people I know that were buried and the square footage, each of these house lots has between 90 and 100 graves. Maybe half were exhumed.
The Court Street Cemetery spans eight city blocks and was Tucson's primary burial ground from 1875 to 1909. Teal estimates between 7,000 and 8,000 people were put to rest there. Around 1907, the city agreed to open two new cemeteries, close the Court Street one, and develop the land.
Undertaking companies offered to dig up people's family members and friends and move them, but there were many people that had come to Tucson and died, or the families didn't have any money, and so about half of the people that were buried here are still here, underneath the houses, businesses, roads, sidewalks.
In some cases, Teal believes they quite literally did the poltergeist thing, where they moved the headstones to a new cemetery, but not the bodies.
The other people that were dug up and moved, the tombstones are sort of scattered all over the cemetery, whereas those are all just sort of lined up in nice rows.
Many of them were people who had no family in town and therefore didn't have anyone who'd pay to have their bodies moved. So what happens when someone like Teal uncovers a body?
All the people that were found in the Catholic half of the cemetery have been reburied in Holy Hope Cemetery, which is the Catholic diocese cemetery here in town.
As for the others, some of them are just sitting in a museum with no one to claim them. And while having homes built on top of a burial ground may seem wild, it's not as uncommon as you might think. Thiel says many American cities have paved over cemeteries. And as far as buying the homes built there,
there's no sort of general duty to disclose facts like this for a seller.
That's Shell Chan Hu, an associate professor of law at the University of Arizona. She says to her knowledge, nothing like this has been litigated in the state, but it would depend on the facts of the case.
For example, if the seller knows the fact that the house was built on an old cemetery and there might be bodies still buried underneath the house, and if, for example, the jury decides that this fact will materially affect the value of the house and that a buyer cannot easily discover this fact, then the seller of the home has a duty to disclose the fact.
It's similar to a major plumbing issue that could not be discovered through an ordinary inspection. In Arizona, realtors are not obligated to disclose if a murder, suicide, or natural death occurs on a property either. But for people like Thompson and Thiel, the history is part of what makes the neighborhood so special. Thiel gives tours of it to keep the history alive.
I like to find out the stories of the forgotten people. Not the famous people, but the people that nobody remembers.
And Thompson maintains a shrine in his front yard to make sure the people of the past are not forgotten. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In politics news. On Thursday, the Appropriations Committee in the Arizona House advanced the 16 bills that make up a new state budget over the opposition of Democrats and two far-right Republicans. From the Politics Desk, Cameron Sanchez reports.
Lawmakers are staring down a $1.4 billion deficit. The budget package passed out of committee proposes sweeping cuts to address that shortfall. During the hearing, Democrats expressed concern over cuts to funding for K-12 and higher education and bemoaned a lack of new funding for affordable housing. But when it came time to approve or reject the budget bills, Republican Committee Chair David Livingston barred lawmakers from either party a chance to explain their votes. There's still an opportunity to amend the budget, but Livingston said he'll give more consideration to the concerns of those who voted for the budget than those who opposed it. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Your smartphone isn't just a phone. It's your alarm, your photo album, your calendar, your wallet. Maybe you use it to shop, check your email, the time or the weather or traffic. These days, your phone is your connection to the outside world. Make the most of that connection and listen to NPR and KJZZ on 91.5, online, or on the mobile app. In Fronteras News. The U.S. government has approved a lithium mine exploration project near Wickiup, Arizona, after working with area tribes to protect a sacred site in the region. From the Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Michel Marisco reports.
The Bureau of Land Management approval allows Big Sandy Incorporated to drill and test up to 131 holes across roughly 21 acres of BLM-managed public land for viability. The approval comes after several comment periods and the resulting feedback. Plans were revised after the Hualapai tribe expressed its concern that a nearby groundwater well near a sacred site would be used. BLM Kingman Field Office Manager Amanda Dodson.
The proponent has also committed to providing the opportunity for the Hualapai tribe and other descendant tribal communities to monitor ground disturbing activities on site.
Instead, water will be trucked to the site. If the site is deemed viable, Big Sandy Incorporated will be required to go through the National Environmental Policy Act, which includes further tribal consultation. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
In business news, maker spaces are places where people can create, invent, and learn using different tools, materials, and machines. Phoenix Forge is a maker space run by Gateway Community College, and it's open to students and the public. Christina Estes got a tour of the downtown space.
Phoenix Forge is often described as being like a gym.
I think it's all set up.
But instead of treadmills, weights, and basketballs, members have saws, laser cutters, and sewing machines.
You can be as experimental and creative as you want.
Tyree Evans is cutting wood for a nightstand. He's also used the wood shop to build shelves for a local restaurant and design a chair as part of his upcoming furniture collection. As a college student, Evan gets free access to the space.
There was a point in time where I was spending more time here than at home because, like, that's what I needed.
He's explored almost every corner, from jewelry, textiles, and electronics to digital design, 3D printers, and metals.
metal shop here has pretty much everything you need for working with ferrous metals, copper, aluminum.
Community engagement manager Lucas Anderson says Phoenix Forge offers two monthly memberships, $75 for individuals and $150 for small businesses with multiple users.
We always have staff on to help you learn as you go or troubleshoot through a challenge or just maybe hang out and talk about making stuff.
In addition to memberships, they offer specialty classes like ring making,
where you're learning to cut and bend and solder and attach a base plate mount to stone. It only takes a couple classes to get to that place. It takes a lot of hours to get good at it, but you can make something in really only about 4 hours of class time.
I'm testing this piece.
Kate Benjamin makes all kinds of things related to cats.
Toys for cats, beds, scratchers, and then fun things for cat lovers. Anything that kind of busts the crazy cat lady stereotype.
She has her own design studio, but not the space or money for a 3D printer or laser cutter she uses here.
I'm cutting acrylic here, 1/8 inch acrylic. And I think that it's taken my creativity to a whole new level. So I like the idea of making things that are unique, that are handmade, especially when small businesses are competing with, you know, the big companies and the big factories from overseas. You want to offer something unique to your customers.
Overall, we've got about a little over $1 million worth of equipment here.
Executive Director Bruce Balfour says they're working with a local nonprofit to offer a national sewing certification that would open doors for apprenticeships in the fashion industry. And they're talking with an Arizona company that makes parts for mining equipment.
They want to do some basic training for their forging staff that they want to hire to get them some experience. And so we can do that kind of thing in our metal shop and get them exposure to that. And then they can teach kind of a limited curriculum in that space themselves if they want to.
Plans are underway to maximize untapped space at their 7th Avenue and Van Buren location by adding a glass blowing studio, observation window, and coffee shop.
The idea is to get us more integrated with the community. So it'll bring people in.
This summer, Phoenix Forge will host its first market where makers can showcase their handmade products. It's perfect timing for Tyree Evans to launch his furniture collection.
I don't think I've really would have thought like about making an assembly line of products if it weren't for, you know, the availability of prototyping it with 3D printing first, or, you know, using some of the scrap wood that they have in the wood shop to kind of just throw something together, or just bouncing ideas off of other creatives that, you know, are also members at the Forge. I mean, that's been pivotal to the process for me.
Phoenix Forge will host a free open shop night on Friday, June 21st. Visitors can register in advance to use some of the most popular tools and equipment, including sewing machines and saws, 3D printers and laser cutters. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, we turn musical. Here's Sam Dingman.
So, Mark, I have a hypothetical for you.
Okay.
Let's say you're sitting around a campfire, somebody busts out a guitar. What is one of the first songs that gets played?
Whew, boy. Probably either Blown in the Wind or, I guess, traditionally, Kumbaya, right?
For sure. But I would argue that somewhere in that top five is the song Wagon Wheel.
Okay.
You know, rock me mama like a wagon wheel, rock me mama any way you feel.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty standard one too, I suppose.
Exactly. And it's a song that I think a lot of people know as a hit single by Darius Rucker, but it was originally recorded by a band called Old Crow Medicine Show 20 years ago.
Hmm.
Old Crow is actually coming to Scottsdale Performing Arts Center this weekend, and I got to talk to the band's co-founder and lead singer, Ketch Secor.
Is he tired of playing that song?
You would think.
Yeah.
But it's actually the opposite.
Huh.
He told me that he sees playing the song as part of the band's mission, and he also told me that he has had music in his bones since he was a little kid.
There's a story in my family that goes, when I was a kid, I lived in New Orleans. I learned to walk and talk in New Orleans. My dad left me out in front of a liquor store so that he could go in and make a purchase. That doesn't just sound like child rearing in the 1980s. And so he's like, wait here, son. And I had seen people in the French Quarter dancing for change. And I started dancing And when he came back out of the liquor store, I had a pile of money in front of me.
Well, there's an early signal that music can be a viable career, right?
Yeah.
You also said once, when you drag a bow across four strings, it's like a bodily smile. When do you remember having that feeling for the first time?
I can't think of the first time I felt it, but the reason I started playing the fiddle, though, is because so much of the music that makes, you know, all genres in America is dance music. Wanting there to be a reason for people to get together through music.
Yeah.
And dancing is the next best thing to sex, which is the, you know, the essential act. I think it's really about, you know, it's kind of snake charming here.
Uh-huh.
You're just trying to get dance partners together so you can, you know, keep the species going. You know, that you think of the parentage in this dance. It's a dance between largely the founders of America who come from Europe and then the founders of America who come from Africa. These two founders who are not allowed to dance together in the United States, you know, really up until, you know, present day, 50 years ago or something. This taboo dance of black and white on these shores. And the thing about the fiddle is that the fiddle is the melody. And the banjo, it's the drum from West Africa. So, you know, the fiddle meets the banjo. That happens here in North America. And then we're all the great-great-grandkids running around.
Wow. You know, Ketch, I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about folk music as subversively as the way that you just did.
It's the most subversive form out there. I mean, it's talk about some rabble rousing politic and stuff here, man.
Yeah.
Like you could go to this stuff would get you hung.
So you told Rolling Stone once, you said, I remember when I was a kid thinking I was born too late for the party, that all the cool stuff had happened. Can you tell me a little bit about that feeling? What was the party? What was the cool stuff you felt like you were born too late for?
Oh, the March on Washington in 1963 and the Bob Dylan singing The Times They Are a-Changin' and Martin Luther King linking arms with Julian Bond. And, you know, when music was on the front lines of change and advocacy, one of the things that's really changed is that the power of song has been crazily diluted. You know, it barely has, you know, the cultural fluency that it once had, and it, you know, it's just a lot less impactful.
Kind of in that vein, I wanted to ask, have you ever spent any time reading the YouTube comments on Wagon Wheel?
No, I never have. Are they any good? Are they interesting?
They're deeply, deeply reverent, and there's just comment after comment after comment of people saying Wagon Wheel was the favorite song of somebody they loved who died, and periodically they get together with their friends and they play it and it feels like that person is there again. It seems like people come to this song to ask it to hold massive, massive feelings of longing and regret. I wonder what you make of that.
I feel really humbled by it and honored that I could have contributed something to the world that could, you know, carry away somebody's grief and or be a you know, a long distance phone call to the beyond. Country music is a unique body. And when I'm up there on the stage singing country music with my fiddle under my chin, I look out there in my audience and I see people who have vehement disagreement with one another. And yet they both bought a ticket to this show.
Right.
And so I know what it looks like, what civility looks like, because I see it every night. It's hands waving together. And one of the things I think that really unites us that we often fail to see is that we all share pain. We all share in grief. You know, the people that died in the opioid crisis are the children of left and right.
Mm-hmm.
The people who have died in school shootings are the children of left and right.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is all very interesting to me to hear you talk about, because in 2018, you told the Providence Journal You said there's a role for certain songs and songwriters to spin a political narrative, and generally I'm not one of them. I'm mostly here as an entertainer. Do you still feel that way, or do you feel like your relationship to the politics that can be associated with this music has shifted?
Well, I think the only difference now is that in 2018, you know, I didn't have a smartphone. I was still on a flip phone in 2018. And so I didn't have, even though the band had 500,000 Facebook followers, I didn't have any engagement with any of them. And I'd never used Instagram before, and I was still checking my email at the public library, man. Anyhow, now that I decided, well, I guess I'm not going to be a Luddite anymore, and I'm going to get out here with everybody else on their smartphones, I just find it to be kind of vapid and disappointing. As a person who just hasn't had that much experience with social media, I'm just less convinced of any one artist's real role in saying, well, this is how the country should go on this topic.
Yeah.
Because social media doesn't really do much but fan the flames.
Sure. But if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like you do feel like something an artist can do is create a space. Like if we can all sing along to Wagon Wheel together, what else can we talk about?
Yeah. I don't know, man. These are really challenging times in our country to get along with each other. And when I just stay here with my instruments and songs, I feel like a tree standing by the water, like they say in the old song. You know, I feel unmovable. Like it says in the Bible, I shall not be moved.
And that makes you feel hopeful.
Yeah, because, I mean, the you know, the times change, man, and the water keeps on flowing. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel.
Hey, mama, rock me. Thank you so much.
Y'all come on out and see us. It's a good time.
In education news, it's been more than 50 years since NASA has sent humans to the moon. That will change in a few years with the Artemis 3 mission, which is expected to bring multiple astronauts, including the first woman, person of color, and an international partner, to the moon's surface. Greg Haney has details on the scientific instruments NASA says it will bring along, two of which are being developed with the help of Arizona researchers.
The three scientific instruments cover a variety of fields ranging from seismology to biology. The Artemis 3 mission is scheduled to launch in 2026 and will install the tools on the moon's south pole. Angela Maruziak is an associate research professor at the University of Arizona. She is part of the team that is developing the Lunar Environment Monitoring Station, or LEMS. She says there are different types of events that require seismometers, which record the movement of the ground during an earthquake, or in this case, moonquake.
So the shallow events that are a little bit more rare are essentially caused by the moon shrinking as it cools, not unlike, you know, how fruit can get wrinkly as it gets a little overripe.
Maruziak says they will be able to measure other deeper events as well.
The other type of really common event is what's called a deep moonquake. Clearly, seismologists are very clever in how we name things. So these are events that happen deep down in the mantle, and those are caused by tidal interactions between the Earth and the moon. So like how the moon causes tides on Earth that affect our oceans, we cause deep moonquakes on the moon.
Maruziak added they anticipate they will be able to measure when objects such as asteroids strike the moon. Seismology has been a consistent area of focus for NASA astronauts. A seismometer was included in the scientific package brought along in the very first manned mission to the moon with Apollo 11. The new station, LEMS, will be a continuation of that focus.
Apollo laid a really great groundwork, so to speak, for what we could expect with Artemis. Now that we're heading to the South Pole, there's some other cool features that might be able to generate additional sources of moonquakes. So we're really looking forward to what we're going to be able to see.
The next instrument is called the Lunar Dielectric Analyzer. It is being developed under the helm of University of Tokyo professor Hirdy Miyamoto with support from the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency. Miyamoto is an affiliate member with the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson.
People kind of think that surface
of the moon is well understood. But actually, that is not true.
He says the small tool will measure how the moon's surface, called the regolith, responds to electromagnetic waves. That will tell scientists characteristics of the regolith, like how porous it is and whether it holds substances that evaporate. That is crucial as scientists are looking for a key element to life on Earth.
If water exists on the surface, then it should be in the form of ice.
Miyamoto said it is known that there is ice on the moon, but using this tool will help them get a better understanding of how much might really be up there.
Ice may be provided by comets or meteorites in the past. And once it hit the surface of the moon, may escape from the moon, but the lunar gravity is still pretty strong.
Miyamoto said that means it's possible the water migrated to other parts of the moon, such as the southern polar region. The final instrument is called the Lunar Effects on Agricultural Flora, or LEAF. It will be used to study plant growth and photosynthesis in space radiation and partial gravity. It is being developed by Space Lab Technologies in Boulder, Colorado. Ryan Watkins is a program scientist with NASA's headquarters.
So this particular experiment is more tied to looking at like long-term human presence on the moon. How can we support humans via nutrition, and what kind of crops can we grow?
The crews plan to bring duckweed, thale cress, and field mustard.
They've been genetically modified to grow, germinate rapidly. So they'll have like a controlled experiment, look at how they grow over the course of a few days. Then they'll actually freeze them, isn't the word. I think they inject them with something to stop the growth. And then the astronauts will return a few of them back to Earth to study. But then the rest will continue to grow and germinate over the course of, I think it's up to 14 days. And they'll monitor those until the lunar night hits and they ultimately end up, then they will actually freeze.
Watkins says the instruments were chosen based on payload weight, scientific significance, and whether they needed humans to deploy them.
There were plenty of other proposals that had high scientific and technical merit, but these were the three that really rose to the top from all of those categories.
Each will play a role in helping NASA learn how to develop and sustain a long-term human presence on the moon. Greg Hawney, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, in Tribal Natural Resources, which is supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. For more than three decades, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act has provided federal aid to people harmed by the Atomic Testing Program. Many of those affected in Arizona are tribal members. Gabriel Pietrazio reports on the Navajo Nation's next steps to revive RECA, which sunset on Monday.
Obviously, we're very disappointed. We're very upset that it had to come to this.
Justin Ahostine is with the Navajo Nation Washington office. He says there are only two options left now that Congress has failed to extend the program known as RECA.
One is, again, the National Defense Authorization Act.
Amendments could be added to the annual defense spending bill as early as this week.
The other is to continue to push a standalone bill.
But that alternative would require a two-thirds supermajority vote to suspend House rules.
We're confident that we have the votes to pass RECA. What we're not confident about is getting the support for the suspension of rules, because Republicans like to do everything within order, but, you know, it's not off the table.
Ahostine insists House Speaker Mike Johnson's inaction to bring a floor vote has emboldened the Navajo Nation.
We have so much momentum behind this at this point. We're just going to keep fighting.
Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. It's made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ, your news and information station. Stay hydrated.